So, Bob.
So, Brooke.
Let me stop and say, Bob Wright is the author of Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. Tell me what you did last week.
Last week, I was walking across a portion of Missouri.
How many miles?
I did 120. There were seven walking days that totaled 120 miles.
Do you think this enhances mindfulness?
Well, I do. I mean, mindfulness is, you know, it's often described as kind of living in the moment, stopping and smelling the roses. If you really look at its historical use in Buddhism, the term mindfulness, it's more about seeing the world with a kind of a clarity and alertness and a kind of objectivity. And I would say that yes, going and exploring a part of the world and trying to put aside preconceptions is mindful in the true sense of the word.
Do you suggest that mindfulness can combat the tribalism that now plagues the nation? And you were a little surprised by your own tribalism, weren't you?
I've long been aware that I am subject to all the kinds of cognitive biases and impulses that constitute what I'd call the psychology of tribalism, and which I think is behind much of the trouble afflicting America and the larger world. If you look at, you know, sectarian conflict, national conflict. And I had long ago written about evolutionary psychology, which has an explanation of why we are subject to the psychology of tribalism.
Was that Non-Zero?
That was The Moral Animal in 1994. But the thing about evolutionary psychology is it diagnoses the problem. It says that, yes, we are not designed to see the world clearly. We're designed to have these in-group biases and various other kinds of biases, but it doesn't tell you what to do about it. Whereas Buddhism has both a diagnosis and a prescription. It says the trouble is we don't see the world clearly, and then it gives you something to do about it to clarify your vision.
Basically, mindfulness, meditation, helps you track your emotions. If you know what you're feeling, you can combat the impulse to instantly act on them.
That's right. Mindfulness makes you more aware of, among other things, the subtle ways in which your feelings are guiding your thought and your perception. And this is something that modern psychology is increasingly seeing, this fine intertwining of kind of affect and cognition. They're seeing that really so-called cognitive biases are not just cognitive, they involve feeling. And Buddhism was onto this a long time ago. And so mindfulness meditation helps you see the way feelings, even in subtle ways, I don't just mean like rage and vengeance, but subtle ways that feelings lead you to misperceive the world.
And that was one of the observations in your book that I love the most, that mindfulness through meditation teaches you not to trust your gut. Your gut does not hold the wisdom of the ages. It's a reflection of our lizard brain, or at least a brain that has to respond reflexively to a very different world. It's dumb, your gut. And this helps you scrutinize what those emotions tell you.
Right. I mean, amazing as it sounds, our brains were designed by natural selection to do one thing, get genes into the next generation in a particular environment, in something more like a hunter-gatherer environment. And so now, you put us in the modern world, and first of all, I don't think that getting genes in the next generation should be the be-all and end-all. I'd rather focus more on like keeping the planet together, and you know. But also, we're in a very different environment. And that's why I see crazy things like road rage that don't seem to make any sense. I mean, rage made a little more sense in a different environment.
Explain.
Well, in a hunter-gatherer environment, rage gets you to demonstrate that you cannot be taken advantage of. Somebody tries to steal a possession, a mate, whatever. You show you're willing to fight. You get mad enough to fight. Even if you lose the fight, you've demonstrated that there's a cost, okay? Well, you take this out on the highway. Well, first of all, nobody who's watching is, are you ever going to see again? There's no point in demonstrating anything to them. Plus, now you're going 80 miles an hour, and the consequences could be worse. And, you know, same with a lot of things. Anxiety, guilt, a lot of things kind of misfire in the modern environment.
Give me an example of how guilt misfires.
Well, for one thing, it's sometimes harder to assuage. Like, you might feel you did something to somebody, and you wonder, did I offend them? And you feel a little guilty. But they're not, like, living right next door to you. You won't see them around the campfire that night. And that kind of thing can fester. for a long time and just go unresolved, and you're left there wondering. You know, it's not quite worth emailing them about. And that just didn't happen in the natural environment. Everyone you interacted with pretty much all the time.
So what you've got is an accumulation of, like a haystack full of little twigs that you carry around like a weight that are meaningless and that don't matter.
Yeah, well, one of the take-homes of Buddhism is that you should not assume that your feelings have the meaning they seem to have. You know, when they tell you this person is a bad person or you know, you should be upset about this, don't assume that they're giving you good guidance. And mindfulness meditation is, to a large extent, a way of looking at your feelings from a more objective standpoint. It doesn't mean you don't have feelings. You experience them, but you exert more conscious control over which feelings you let kind of carry you away and carry your train of thought away.
First of all, you are not the first person I would assume would take a plunge into Buddhism, because although you are analytical and although you've been very engaged in explorations of ethics and morality and evolution and God, you're also, I'll stop short of saying cynical.
I have a feeling that this isn't a compliment, whatever's coming next.
You seem to be someone who's far more engaged in examining faith or a belief system than in embracing it.
Well, it's
How's
true
that?
It's true that I'm not a natural meditator for various reasons, and I'm maybe not what you think of as a meditator. It doesn't come easily to me. I don't have a good attention span.
Me either.
So
you have
on.
ADD?
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
You were describing the process of meditating at this, what was it, a five-day silent place?
It was like
place?
A seven-day silent meditation retreat.
Yeah, and a lot of this has to do with focusing on your breath.
Yeah,
and
that's where you start.
You found it hard to stay focused for more than, say, like 15 seconds at the beginning?
Oh, yeah. I went a whole day. I mean, we were doing like 5.5 hours of sitting meditation every day, and I went well more than a day before I counted, you know, 5-10 breaths.
I have the exact same problem. It's almost excruciating because it's boring, right?
Yeah, but that's why it took a retreat for me to get through it. I mean, to get into meditation at all. I had to go to a silent meditation retreat. Not everyone does, but that's what it took for somebody like me. But as for the fact that I'm analytical, as you said, I mean, mindfulness meditation is more analytical than people appreciate, in the sense that it's a way of learning to kind of step back and in a certain sense, analyze the feelings and thoughts inside your head, at least a way of viewing them with a kind of a calm objectivity.
I have an idea for spellbinding radio right now.
I'm ready.
Show me how to meditate.
Show you how to meditate. Okay, the standard thing is, first of all, I don't have a license. No one should do anything I say from here on in, but
don't do this at home.
What they typically say is, you know, close your eyes, assume a relaxed posture, pay attention to your breath, maybe pick a point like where it's entering your nose and exiting your nose, for example, whatever's comfortable. Some people pay attention to the feeling of the breath in the abdomen, the rising and falling of the abdomen, but pick something to pay attention to. And then, you know, just watch it. And you're going to have trouble and your mind is going to wander. Don't get mad at yourself or beat yourself up. When you notice that your mind is wandering, that's a small kind of victory. So if anything, congratulate yourself. And then you'll get back to the breath.
Okay, now I'm a child of the 70s. And I did do TM, Transcendental
yeah.
Meditation. I learned it when I was studying theater in London. There's a cliche for you. In any case, it was very hard. They gave me my mantra. I had to stay focused on that. And when I wandered off the mantra to think of other things, my brain going, you're supposed mm-hmm. to go gently back and you quiet the static in your head.
Right.
But this isn't the same as that.
Well, the goal of the breathing part is, I mean, in both cases, you're trying to focus your mind. And there are various ways of doing that. A mantra, focus on your breath, focus on something else. But the question is, what happens once you attain the focus? And in mindfulness meditation, especially in this kind of Vipassana tradition that the retreat I was describing was in, you then go on to appraise whatever is happening experientially. It could be a sound, could be feelings, could be thoughts. You have to calm the mind, and that's what the focusing segment is for. Now, there are kinds of meditation that just persist with the focusing, which can carry you into a state of real bliss. And I've done that, and it's great, but it's not mindfulness. Bliss is not the point of mindfulness meditation. Now, mindfulness meditation is calming and therefore pleasant, and I would say brings a kind of pleasantness to your life if you pursue it and try to apply it to your whole life, but it's not the pursuit of bliss.
Okay, so once you've calmed your brain, then you start thinking about other things or focusing on other things in the environment. Like your brain is calm. You've done the breathing for 2 hours or something. And now, once you've gotten good at that, no matter how many days it takes you, then you start concentrating on the sound of a bird outside the window, or what?
You could. I would say what's most relevant to this question of tribalism is focusing on your feelings and look at how you're reacting to things.
What feeling?
I remember I was at a retreat once and there was this guy who started snoring. He was falling asleep. And this really annoyed me. And, you know, and at first it just annoyed me. I'm like, I'm trying to meditate. And then I remembered, oh, wait, you're supposed to just be aware of your reaction. And the thing about a meditation retreat is you can get so, I guess you might say, good at this, at least temporarily, several days into a retreat, that you can, once you see a feeling, like I see my kind of wrath for the person, I literally see it and I focus on it in a way that just dissolves it in the moment.
Now, you mean like as a big gray ball?
Well, you see where in your body, I mean, feelings reside somewhere in your body. If you, like if you are feeling sad and you sit down and just examine the sadness, which is a good shortcut, by the way, skip the breath, just wait until you have a feeling like sadness and sit down, close your eyes and say, well, what does sadness feel like? And you'll probably notice it tends to be some of it is up around your eyes and maybe elsewhere. But just the very act of observation, you're no longer thinking the sad thoughts that the sadness would make you think. Instead, you're just looking at the sadness. And that in itself is a measure of liberation.
You had mentioned that mindfulness helps you combat our natural tribalism because that's an emotional thing and you can identify it and then you can manage it better. And a big part of that is confirmation bias, which is our tendency to accept and retain information that supports our views and reject or ignore information that doesn't. Because in the final analysis, confirmation bias has nothing to do with thinking and everything to do with feeling.
Right. You know, confirmation bias is what drives fake news on both sides. You know, I think we've all done this thing of either sharing something on Facebook or retweeting something that turned out to be misleading or untrue, and we shared it without actually examining it. And if you ask yourself, why did you share it or retweet it? The answer is because it felt good. For example, recently, Trump went to Japan, and this story spread that he had shown that he didn't even understand that Japanese automakers make cars in the U.S. It turned out if you looked at his remarks in their entirety, that wasn't true. He clearly did understand that. But that spread.
But CNN reported.
To the point of CNN doing a little piece about how he didn't even understand this, and that was just not true. But if you ask, how did the story get magnified in the first place? You know, it's like you see the tweet or whatever, and it feels good to share it because you have this idea that Trump is stupid, and it feels good to confirm that view. I mean, any news that seems to reflect unfavorably on the opposite tribe, it feels good to see, it feels good to share. And if you look closely at what makes you retweet things without careful examination, it is a feeling. It is, and that's the kind of feeling that you will become more aware of if you do mindfulness meditation.
So it holds, if not the cure, at least a treatment for our polluted media environment.
It's the beginning of progress, yes.
And there's another kind of bias that you talk about in the book that maybe holds treatment for our poisonous politics.
Yeah, there's a really fascinating cognitive bias that I think has not gotten enough attention. And it's a form of what's called attribution error.
And that is the error that lies at the root of our tribalism?
A lot of it, I think. In everyday life, you might be standing at a checkout counter. The person in front of you is rude to the clerk, and you think that's a rude person. So you're attributing the rudeness to the kind of person they are. When, you know, for all you know, they have just found out that their spouse has cancer or something. You just don't know why they're behaving that way. And it turns out that how we do the attribution depends on whether somebody is in our tribe or outside of our tribe. So if it's somebody in our tribe and they do something good, we say, well, yeah, that's the kind of person they are. They're a good person. If they do something bad, then we explain it away and attribute it not to the kind of person they are, but to circumstance. You know, they were under peer group pressure or whatever. Whereas people in the enemy tribe, if they do something bad, you say, yeah, that's the kind of person they are. I mean, Trump supporters do bad things. Naturally, they did this thing. If they do something good, you explain it away as being due to circumstance. And I think this kind of thing, it gets us into wars, and it does help sustain the tribal conflict. And what
But even more so, once you've got this explanation, you have no need to seek another.
Right.
So basically, this kind of attribution bias is a really big impediment to breaching the walls between tribes and increasing our understanding.
It impedes understanding. And there are two kinds of empathy. And this gets at, I think, a kind of a misconception about meditation. I think people would imagine that the whole point of mindfulness meditation is to give you empathy in the traditional feel their pain sense. You know, in other words, emotional empathy. I feel sorry for the people on the other side. There's also something called cognitive empathy, which is just understanding what it's like to be them and why they do the things they do. And mindfulness meditation can help you, regardless of whether you even care about them, regardless of whether you feel their pain, it can help you get a clearer view of why they did the things they did. And in the case of Trump, it can help you understand that, well, it's not as simple as them all being racist or all being stupid or all being anything else. Different Trump voters were responding to different things. Some of them are actual issues that need addressing and that deserve to be addressed. Some of them aren't. But in any event, it seems to be the first step toward not getting Trump elected again is to understand clearly how he got elected. And I think, you know, mindfulness can help. And it's important to understand that our minds, in some sense, naturally impede this kind of understanding, and we should be suspicious of them.
You suggest in the book that mindfulness will actually make you a more effective political actor.
Yeah, a more skillful actor. Skillful is a very commonly used word in Buddhism. It's the goal of a lot of this is to become more skillful in the way you deal with your own problems and the way you deal with other people.
Well, we know now that it can make us more knowledgeable, but how does it make us more effective?
Well, for starters, I mean, as you said, understanding why people do things should help you deal with them skillfully. I mean, in this case, there's a more specific effect of these cognitive biases. These things happen to reinforce Trump's narrative, right? Because his narrative is coastal elites hold you in contempt. So if we remain under the influence of this attribution error that keeps us thinking very poorly of these people and saying things about Trump and his followers that reflect that view, that just reinforces his narrative. And when we spread fake news under the influence of confirmation bias, we sustain Trump's narrative that we're always telling lies about him, that the media, it's the dishonest, lying media. So you can see in a very concrete way how this is not helpful in this context.
Also, you've said that you don't think that the resistance benefits all that much from people on the left spouting off their frustration, that they could keep their powder dry and actually channel it into some kind of effective political action.
Well, yeah, the other thing about outrage is that it, in addition to sometimes impeding your vision, hating the other tribe, spending a lot of time in getting outraged over everything Trump says, in addition to kind of clouding your vision, it just takes time. And it's time you could be spending focusing on tactical issues like how do we go about advancing our interests and addressing these really big, complicated issues like, you know, international trade and automation and so on have had a bad impact on the job situation in parts of America. What are we going to do about that in a way that's consistent with our values? And you know, immigration does in the short run create competition for low-wage jobs. What are we going to do about that in a way that's consistent with our values? It takes time to think these things through.
But you first have to concede that that may be true.
Yeah, you have to entertain that possibility. Yeah.
Because there's still debate over something that the experts tend to agree with, that immigration does have a tendency to hold down wages.
In the short run.
Not so much the competition, but it tends to hold down wages.
I mean, there are definitely people in America who are competing with low-wage workers, both in other countries and immigrants, for work. These are real things, and neglecting them is what lets things get to a point where a xenophobic politician can do well.
And one side thinks the other side is totally clueless.
Right.
Now, you wrote in Wired recently that you hold out hope for salvation by mindfulness, even though most Americans don't, in fact, meditate. And worse still, you observe that what meditators there are seem to cluster on one side of the aisle. You wrote that when you go to meditation retreats, the parking lots have featured a number of Volvos, Subarus, and Priuses, few, if any, pickup trucks, and zero bumper stickers that say, "Make America Great Again." So is this all effort you're proposing on one side of the aisle?
No, I'm not. I mean, I would
say. And can it work if it is?
I would say, even if it is on one side of the aisle, even if it's on either side of the aisle, I think meditation can begin to defuse things in a healthy way. Because if we are not conveying to the other side the idea that we hold them in contempt, for example, then that is going to exert something of a calming effect on their own way of thinking about things, I would think. But beyond that, you know, although when I go to Buddhist meditation retreats, it's true, it's definitely a liberal crowd. Mindfulness is entering the workplace and the schools without the term Buddhism attached to it. And for political reasons, it has to. I mean, you know, you cannot encourage school boards in Missouri or somewhere to bring mindfulness into the classroom if you call it Buddhist practice. But the fact is that there is this kind of purely secular kind of mindfulness that's making a lot of progress. You know, I have a sister who is conservative Christian. She voted for Trump. She's done mindfulness meditation without the word Buddhism attached to it.
Okay. But I want you to make a better case to all the people who say to me when I say we need to listen to the other side, they say, why is it always the liberals that have to listen to the other side and they never listen to us? Why should we mindfully meditate when they aren't going to? What's the, you know, what's in it for us?
This surfaces in other contexts. It's like, you know, in the war on terrorism, if you say, well, I think some of our more adventurous militaristic policies are exacerbating the terrorism, they say, well, wait, you're saying unilateral disarmament? Why should we stop if they're not stopping? Well, there are cases where unilateral disarmament or some degree of it actually is effective. I'm arguing, you know, I disarmament's a misleading term.
Yeah, I don't think you're helping your case by using that as an example.
No, but what I mean is, in the case of terrorism, not invading Iraq and not bombing people so indiscriminately that you kill a lot of civilians helps in the long run because you're no longer doing some of the things that are amplifying the hatred on the other side. And I really believe if we spread less misleading information about the opposition and say less gratuitously unflattering things about them, which isn't to say you don't criticize Trump when he does something horrible. It's that you try to distinguish between the genuinely horrible things he's done, and there's enough of those to keep you occupied, and the kind of form of outrage that, you know, including just things like, look, I was as amused as anyone by Melania wearing high heels to a hurricane. But, you know, when you look at the way that plays out on the other side, is it really worth the time of, like, spreading that as, like, a whole liberal meme that we're making fun of the First Lady? Because, you know, I mean, I do think that there are these feedback effects, and a calmer, more deliberate approach is the beginning of calming things down. Because a big part of Trump's support derives from the idea that his followers are hated and held in contempt by coastal elites.
So to turn this around starts with breathing.
Yeah, breathing as a gateway to a clearer view of things. You know, when you respond to everything outrageous he does with massive force, you're in a way letting him call the tune. I mean, a good example is North Korea. He does a lot more outrageous tweeting about North Korea than he does about Iran. But if you ask me, right now there's a higher risk of war with Iran than with North Korea. But that's getting largely neglected because it's just not as good a show. He's not making fun of a particular person in Iran the way he is in North Korea. And I don't think liberals are paying enough attention to the current policy of providing Saudi Arabia arms so they can massively bomb Yemen, which they see as part of a war with Iran, and kill a lot of civilians in a way that I think is slowly drawing us toward conflict with Iran. I think we're not keeping our eye on the ball.
I also think getting exercised over the trivial invites fatigue and makes you less likely to sustain effective political action.
Right. I mean, I think part of this is like a mental health issue. I mean, I just know a lot of people who spend a lot of time on Facebook or Twitter, and they wind up feeling horrible because they are so outraged. And I'm not advocating that you use meditation as some kind of insulation from what's going on. That's kind of a misconception. You could use meditation as a sedative. That's not what I'm recommending. I'm recommending using it as a way to clarify your vision. The term I use is mindful resistance. I'm putting out a weekly newsletter now called the Mindful Resistance Newsletter. And it's an attempt to help people focus on things that are really important and help them think about how to process every day's news in a way that is conducive to their own mental health and conducive to their own effective action.
Bob, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Brooke.
Bob Wright is the author of Why Buddhism is True: The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment.